Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm so glad you can join me for a little while to continue thumbing through the big old binder of baseball cards as we move into a new decade. Yes, the 1970s. You know what they say? You didn't live the 1960s if you remember much of it. Well, if you remember much of the 1970s, you regret it an awful lot. Now, I was born late in the 70s, but there's still not too many happy tales from the 70s. And Topps would get off to a rather mundane start to the 1970s with their rather lackluster set from that year. But there are some good things to pull from it. And speaking of good pulls, we pulled a really good player, a great story, a lot of great stories with this guy, even though he was pretty much your quote-unquote average ball player, Bob Aspromonte, card number 529 from the Monster set that Topps released in 1970. Here pictured with the Atlanta Braves, a team that he didn't spend a whole lot of time with. Aspromonte, better known as a member of the Houston Colt 45s / Astros. And one of the great stories of his career comes from his time there. But for the meantime, we will enjoy this picture of Bob Aspromonte down on one knee. I'm trying to figure out what ballpark that is. Wonder how many National League ballparks, because that's not New York. A lot of the times you had a New York stationed photographer for Topps, and that is not Shea Stadium. Certainly the Braves didn't play in Yankee Stadium in 1969, so I'm guessing that might be the old Scheib Park in Philadelphia. But regardless, Bob Aspromonte down on one knee, wistfully looking off into the right field stands, hoping to hit one of those rare home runs in his career. He was not a power hitter, although that great story I have to tell you about certainly deals with power hitting that perhaps was a little divine in these particular moments. So we'll talk about random pull number 529, Bob Aspromonte, in a little bit, plus a look back at the 1970 top set, which is forgettable in many ways, but still has some positives to it. But first, let's talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, which is open 24/7. Always interesting to scroll through the timeline and see what people are talking about here. And a few people talking about our previous podcast on the 69 Topps set, which I put in the good but not great category. And I think 70 Topps is kind of in there as well. Really a lackluster period for Topps here, starting, I'd say, from 66 through 70. Although I have an exception for the 68 Topps set. I do like the 68 set. But, you know, 69 Topps, as I mentioned in the podcast, kind of a love child of 67 and 68 Topps, where you had pretty much the bottom half of the card was almost the 67 Topps set, and the top half of the card featured that big garage sale price sticker that you saw in the 68 top set as well. But we did have a couple reactions to that set. A lot of people do like the set, even though it is not a very exciting set. And C.D. Anderson checks in. He's a big Tigers fan. And he says, my favorite 69, this old card shared with me by my dad. It really helped ignite my collecting fire. Card was about 10 years old then. And it's a card of Bill Frien, a catcher for the Tigers who looks absolutely miserable in this particular picture that Topps used in the 69 Topps set. A lot of other people were chiming in saying that the 69 Topps set wasn't so bad after all, even though it wasn't anything to get really all that excited about. Now, as for our Flashback Friday podcast, we went back to the 1986 Topps set, which also, in my opinion, kind of fits into the good but not great. And that is because, you know, again, I like looking at these sets in context, too. And Topps had some really good sets in 83, 84, 85, and of course the 87 set, which for most collectors is a positive, memorable set. So 86 was kind of a bump in the road. It wasn't the best set that was out there. However, Ben Adams chimes in, says, used to hate that design until the podcast. It's grown on me now. And I'll be honest with you, Ben, 86 Topps, even though I'm still not a huge fan of that set, slowly but surely, it's kind of growing on me. I don't think I'll ever really fall in love with it, but I do have a little more respect for that set now than I did back when I was younger. And again, a lot of the reason why some of the late 80s sets, other than overproduction, why I don't like it. You know, I was on a pretty limited budget when I was buying cards as a kid, so I would often, instead of, you know, investing in the really valuable stuff, I would try to get the most bang for my buck. So if I came into a card shop, and let's say it's like 1990, if I came into a card shop and I only had $5, was I buying 3 or 4 packs of Upper Deck? No. I would, for $5, I'd get probably about 10 packs of 88 tops, or, you know, 6 or 7 packs of 86 tops. And, you know, there just wasn't as much valuable stuff in either of those two sets there. So I've come to regret those decisions now, but that's one of the reasons why 86 tops, other than the fact that it's not a very appealing set. It was one of those bargain bin sets that I latched onto early in my collecting years. Now, the random pull from that podcast was Jack Morris, and I said that while the design of 86 Tops, or the wow factor of 86 Tops, is debatable, the fact that Jack Morris is not in the Hall of Fame, well, that's not debatable. I've said all along that Jack Morris deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. He was a workhorse for the Detroit Tigers for many years. And people forget he won 3 World Series. He won the 84 series with the Tigers, was instrumental in the Twins hanging on for that epic 7-game series in 1991. And he also got a World Series ring in 1992 with the Toronto Blue Jays. So, you know, here's a guy who definitely deserved a far better fate, especially with Hall of Fame votes. Even though his earned run average was not impressive, he certainly had the number of wins, and really the stat that sticks out to me, and we discussed this in the podcast, was complete games. You're never going to have a guy like Jack Morris who, you know, finishes a season with 20, 25 complete games in a season, just because of how pitchers are used these days. You know, you're lucky if you have, at the end of the season, your league leader in complete games has double digits. And the amazing stat that I pulled from that podcast when looking back at his 1983 season, which was the first of 3 20-win seasons in his career. He had 20 exactly in 1983, somehow was left off the All-Star roster that year. But he also had 20 complete games. And here's the amazing thing. He didn't even lead the league in complete games, and he had 20 back then. So, you know, that's something. Even though he has 254 wins, you know, he doesn't cross that magic 300-win threshold, which is also, I think, in danger because of how pitchers are used these days. I really do think that Jack Morris deserves a much more fair shake at the Hall of Fame. And hopefully one day he does get in, because I really do believe that he deserves it. Now, after that long diatribe about Jack Morris, Mark Mosley says, Jack Morris is definitely debatable. Now, I don't know if you're debating that Jack Morris should or should not be in the Hall of Fame, or if he's just debatable. There were some off-the-field issues with Jack Morris that we talked about in that podcast. And even as a Blue Jays fan growing up, yeah, I was happy that Jack Morris was part of that 92 World Series team. But there was something that happened to him during the 92 playoffs, and he was not the same, and the wheels really came off in 1993 with Toronto. Now, a couple other things. We've got our auction going on, or we had it going on over the weekend, the 77 Tops pack. I have not yet posted the video break of that pack. In fact, I haven't broken it yet as of the time that you're hearing this podcast, at least the first run on Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. We're working out a payment deal with the auction winner. So once we clear that up, we will do the break of the 77 Tops set. Not set, 77 Tops pack. And I do appreciate all those who did participate in the auction. A lot of people really jumping on this, so we'll keep it going, see how long people want to keep doing it. I can tell you, once we settle up the 77 Tops pack, our next item up for bids will be a rack pack of 84 Tops, a very popular set and design. And I know our friends in San Diego listening to this podcast will be interested in perhaps bidding for that rack pack, because one of the cards visible on the pack, it's on the back of one of those packs, is Tony Gwynn. Of course, the second year card for the late Tony Gwynn. We just passed the anniversary of his death just a few days ago. So if you're a big Padres fan or a Tony Gwynn fan, you may want to keep an eye out to Wax and Gum Stains for that auction. Hopefully we'll be able to set it up this weekend, if not this weekend, shortly thereafter. So keep an eye out on Wax and Gum Stains for that. And then this past weekend, it was Father's Day weekend, and you know, just on a whim, I decided to kind of throw out this question. You know, do you have any cool baseball card stories about your dad to share? And we do have a few to pass along here, some pretty entertaining ones. One from Uncle Dave. My dad bought me my first pack of cards the first time he took me to the store after he came home from Vietnam. And he got a Joe Namath card in it. So not baseball cards, but football cards. So that's great, Dave, that first that your dad came home from Vietnam, but also that you got Broadway Joe out of the pack. Now, Dave would continue, also probably only argument I ever won over him. We moved 2,000 miles and my cards did not go in the moving van, but on my lap the whole way. Very, very smart, Dave. Ben Adams, once again, getting into the conversation here. My dad bought me a my dad bought me back a signed 88 Donruss Ozzie Smith from a game. Only problem was my dad signed Ozzie's name on it. Might have been 88 tops, now that I think about it, probably increased the value. Perhaps, although with 88 tops or Donruss, that is very debatable. Well, Ben, you can't say your dad didn't try. Jeff Farnham with our final Father's Day thought here. My dad saved my cards from the early 70s and didn't throw them away. Give that man a medal. That's incredible. And thanks for those who did chime in. I know, you know, it's very busy on a Sunday, first of all, but also on Father's Day. You're busy, you know, if you are a father, you're busy with your kids, or if your father is still alive, you're busy spending time with him. And that's just as valuable as if you have your own kids. My Father's Day story, you know, I racked my brain. I was trying to think of one in particular, and I just couldn't off the top of my head. And I've shared the story many times about how it was my mother that got me into the hobby by asking me at the grocery store if I wanted some packs of baseball cards, and we got right into it. I would say, you know, if there's a cool story about my dad related to baseball cards, even though he didn't ever, to my knowledge, go out and buy cards, or, you know, we didn't like go to a card shop together. He was never big into the hobby, but he was always big into the sport. And growing up in Brooklyn, New York in the 1940s and 1950s, you know, my dad was 15 years old when the Dodgers left for Los Angeles. So he was right there when, you know, they were contenders and won a lot of pennants, won the World Series in 1955. Baseball cards were a great icebreaker to talk baseball with my dad. Not that I needed an icebreaker, but as I've mentioned before, I was really big on collecting vintage cards even when I was a teenager back in the late 80s and early 90s. So, you know, I may go to a garage sale or a flea market and find a few cards from, say, 1962, 63, 64, and I would show them to my dad, and, you know, we would talk about, you know, maybe the players or the teams that were involved. So a lot of fun stuff that, you know, wasn't necessarily direct from baseball cards. Like I said, he never really, and I shouldn't say like my dad never bought me baseball cards. You know, it's, you know, we didn't have a situation like, you know, some of you guys mentioned, you know, getting a card signed or protecting my baseball cards. You know, I would occasionally get cards as a Christmas gift, or, you know, a few packs thrown into an Easter basket, stuff like that, or a birthday gift. But whenever I got them, it, you know, if I went through them and I found something interesting, you know, Dad was the first person I could go to talk about it, especially those older cards, like I mentioned. So, you know, not quite at the level of some of the stories there, but, you know, it's always a good icebreaker to talk to my father about baseball in general, and especially those older teams. And as I mentioned, that connection to the Brooklyn Dodgers, it was great to do that with my dad. And we still do it. In fact, this past weekend, I visited him and my mom at their house. And I had recently read a biography on Leo Durocher. And, you know, again, the Brooklyn connection, of course, I'm going to lend it to my dad afterwards to read. And, you know, we were just talking about Leo Durocher and the Dodgers and the Giants and Durocher's days playing with the Cardinals and, you know, how different ball players were and the sport of baseball was when Durocher played in the 1920s and 30s. So, you know, it wasn't a baseball card in that opportunity, but it was a pretty neat time to share some stories just through a book. So that's my connection. If you want to share yours, feel free to do so at Wax and Gum Stains, and we'll include them in our next podcast. I certainly want to share all the Father's Day stories if you have one you want to throw in after the fact. So speaking of stories and sharing, whatever you want to share on Wax and Gum Stains, that's our Twitter feed. Like I said, it's open 24/7. Please share it with your friends, those who collect now or who collected back in the day, because we're not only talking about the card sets that we discuss on the podcast or the players that we discuss, but, you know, we also talk about things like Father's Day or funny stories about cards that you acquired along the way, you know, even if they're not related directly to the podcast we're discussing. That, you know, we have some people, they just go out and, you know, after listening to a podcast, they go, you know what, I'm going to spend the $8 and get a box of 1990 Fleer. And, you know, they'll gladly show a picture of that to us. So, you know, whatever's on your mind in the hobby, you're more than welcome to share it again at Wax and Gum Stains. And please do share that Twitter feed with your friends. Also share the fact that we come your way with new episodes every Tuesday morning, 10 o'clock Eastern time. We're going through the big old binder. We're at 1970 right now. We'll go through the 70s, hit 1980. And then I'm still scratching my head as to where we go next. I have an idea, and we'll entertain that. But I'm not going to give away any hints right now. But as of now and through the next 2 to 3 months, we'll be going through the 1970s. So that is what's going on the new episodes. We have our Flashback Friday episodes as well, which we share on the Twitter feed. And of course, you can listen to any new or archived episode on all of our platforms. Our home base is Audio Boom. So check out audioboom.com or the Audio Boom app. Just type in Wax Ecstatic and you'll be directed to our entire library. Also, new and archived episodes can be listened to at iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and Stitcher. So whatever your preferred platform of listening to podcast is, or if you have several of them, we've got several different ways to get the shows to you. And of course, we will hand deliver them to you via Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter as well. Now, there's a neat little connection to the Brooklyn Dodgers and our random poll, Bob Aspromonte. A little trivial bit here. And in fact, you know what? I'll talk about Bob Aspromonte first before we talk about the 1970 top set. Normally, I do it the other way around, but we'll just switch it up here just to make things a little different. Bob Aspromonte was a native of Brooklyn, New York, is a native. He's still alive. And Bob Aspromonte had the good fortune of attending the same high school as several other future Dodgers players, including Sandy Koufax. And the neat connection between Bob Aspromonte and the Brooklyn Dodgers is, and you can wow your friends with this trivial tidbit, he is the last Brooklyn Dodger player to play in the major leagues. He had one game with Brooklyn late in the 1956 season. He had one at-bat. I believe he struck out in that at-bat, and that was it. He would spend several more years in the minor leagues, and then he would make his way back up to the majors via Los Angeles. But when his playing career ended in 1971 with the Mets, he became the last Brooklyn Dodger to play in the major leagues. So if you're a hockey fan, much like J.S. Giguere a few years ago was the last remaining Hartford Whaler player, you know, this was probably 16, 17 years after the Whalers left Hartford for Carolina. Same thing here. If you're a Brooklyn Dodger fan, the answer to the trivia question, who was the last Brooklyn Dodger player to play in the major leagues? No, it was not Jackie Robinson or Duke Snider or Gil Hodges, or you name it. You can go down the line there. Sandy Koufax. That's right. Bob Aspromonte actually played games after Sandy Koufax retired. It is indeed Bob Aspromonte, his last game, September 28th, 1971. with the New York Mets. So a very interesting little tidbit there, a neat little piece of trivia for the Brooklyn Dodgers fans out there. Now, as I mentioned, after that one and only at-bat for Brooklyn, he would go back down through the minor leagues for the Dodgers, including stops in Macon, Georgia, Des Moines, Iowa, the Montreal Royals as well, finally starting to make his way up to Los Angeles in 1960, appearing in just 21 games. And he was a little bit of a role player for the Dodgers, not only in 1960, but 1961, playing primarily third base. So this is where expansion helps a guy like Bob Aspromonte. The National League expands in 1962, adds the New York Mets and the Houston Colt 45s, and Aspromonte is an expansion draft selection for the Colt 45s. They need a veteran third baseman. They find one in him. He's only 24 years old, but this is where he started his full-time career in baseball. He would play 149 games for the Colt 45s in 1962 and put up some pretty respectable numbers, a .266 batting average, 11 home runs, 18 doubles, 59 RBI. Houston was a very tough ballpark to hit it, and even though you had the heat and humidity helping out many batters, it was a very big ball field. And of course, the National League, for the most part, you're dealing with the glory days of the pitcher era in the National League. The National League, especially since the American League adopted the DH rule in 1973, the National League is still known as the pitcher's league and less the offense league that the American League became after the DH, but especially in the early 1960s. And you can thank teams like the Los Angeles Dodgers for putting out Koufax and Drysdale and those dominant pitchers. You have Bob Gibson in St. Louis. Steve Carlton would come up through St. Louis. Later on in the 60s, Tom Seaver. But for the most part, you still had the old school pitching duels going on in the National League. So you didn't see a whole lot of power numbers for a guy in a big ballpark like Colt Stadium was and going up against some of the best pitchers in the 1960s, especially in the National League. However, there's a very interesting story that comes about in Bob Aspromonte's career in 1962. So we're going to do a little sidebar here because it's an amazing story. And I first read about this story in Reader's Digest. I think Reader's Digest is still printed. I don't know. I don't really pay attention to the magazines at the checkout line in the grocery stores anymore. But for those of you too young to remember, Reader's Digest was a collection of stories from various magazines. Sometimes they were snippets from books, and it helped promote the books and the magazines, but really it was just a collection of stories for people too cheap or too lazy to go out and actually buy the book or subscribe to the magazines that were supplying these stories. I had somebody in my family, I don't recall who it is, but somebody in my family was that lazy person who subscribed to Reader's Digest as opposed to a litany of magazines or a pile of books. So when I was a kid, I would often get these secondhand copies of Reader's Digest, which kind of makes it third-hand copies of literature. But I would get these second-hand copies of Reader's Digest, and I would kind of thumb through them, mostly for the jokes. They had some pretty funny jokes in there. But every now and then, you'd find an interesting story in it. And there was a story about Bob Aspromonte. And it wasn't really about Bob Aspromonte. It was really about a young man named Billy Bradley. Now, Bradley was a young boy who was from Arkansas, and a really tragic story. It has a happy ending here, but a really tragic story. He's out playing baseball with some of his friends one summer evening. He goes to take a break, runs over to a water fountain to get a drink of water. Well, just then, a bolt of lightning comes out. Bam! Strikes Billy Bradley. Amazingly, doesn't kill him, but you know, he's around the metal pipes with the water fountain and everything. He gets jolted quite a bit by this lightning strike, and he is temporarily blinded. Now, at the time, they're thinking it's permanent blindness. But it would turn out to be temporary, but it turns out temporary after he goes to a hospital at Houston that specializes in, you know, the types of surgery, the neurological surgeries that would be needed to help him restore his sight. So he and his family go to Houston for these medical treatments. Well, during one of these treatments, or after, you know, during one of these weeks where they go out to Houston for a treatment, they decide to go out to a Colt 45's ball game. And he's given the behind the scenes tour and everything. And, you know, I see, working for a sports team, I see this all the time where you have children with various, you know, medical issues. A lot of the times it's, you know, cancer patients, which is tough. I've lost a young nephew to brain cancer. And, you know, you see these kids come in. And, you know, it's tough, but it's something that is beneficial for both the family and the youngster and, you know, the team and the players, because, you know, you get a chance to build up somebody in a tough time. And I can tell you, being on both sides of this coin with family members who were affected by cancer, you know, it's a nice break from all the sadness, from all the treatments, all the nonsense you have to go through with the medical treatments. And, you know, much like sports is the opiate of the masses, we watch sports for, you know, a 2 or 3 hour escape from the real world. Same thing here. You know, the kid gets the locker room tour, or, you know, gets to run the bases or whatever. You know, it's a fun moment amongst all the sadness and depression. And it's very, very uplifting for that family, not just them, but it's a memory that they can look back on, you know, regardless of how the child's predicament turns out. So, you know, here comes Billy Bradley's family. They bring him to Colt Stadium. They give him the whole tour and everything. And he gets a chance to meet Bob Aspromonte. So Aspromonte, who by all accounts is just one of the nicest people on the face of the earth, really takes to this kid, talks to him, you know, is trying to pump him up, trying to, you know, give him some faith that he's going to pull through this, and he has to believe he's going to pull through this. So Billy Bradley asks Bob Aspromonte, "Hey, can you hit me a home run?" Well, Aspromonte hears this request, and he knows that he's not a big power hitter, and he actually tries to negotiate with Billy Bradley. He's just like, "Well, you know, I'm not a big power hitter. Hey, how about if I get you, you know, a bunch of base hits, you know, if I can do something like that?" Bradley just keeps on, you know, asking him, "Can you please just hit me a home run?" He's like, "Okay, well, I'll try." So he goes, I think, 0-for-3 in the first part of this game. The Bradley family decides to leave early. They get in the car and they're listening on the radio. But Aspromonte, in his final at-bat, hits a home run, and the family's listening to this on the radio, and they're thrilled. And Aspromonte, after the game, post-game interview, you know, dedicates the home run to Billy Bradley. So Bradley, you know, he gets his wish granted, and it's already an amazing story. Well, it gets even crazier. So he continues to go through several operations, and by the next season, he's able to see. So, I mean, that's a miracle in and of itself. Well, the next season they go out to Houston, the family does again, and they meet up with Aspromonte, and you know, it's a nice happy reunion. And Billy has the gall to say, "All right, I can see now. Can you hit a home run for me again?" And, you know, again, Aspromonte, even though he had 11 home runs that year, was not known as a power hitter. So he's kind of put on the spot again. He's just like, "Well, I don't know. I'll try again." So Aspromonte goes up to the plate, I believe, 4 times. So 0-for-4 at the plate. Well, the game goes into extra innings, and the bases are loaded. And what does Aspromonte do? Mr. I'm not really a power hitter hits the game-winning grand slam. I mean, you got to be kidding me, right? So then the story gets even better. Bradley's family goes to a game again later. And once again, he asks Aspromonte, "Hey, can you hit me a home run?" Well, Aspromonte is kind of playing along now. He's just like, "Okay, I'm not a power hitter, but you know what, Billy, every time you're here and every time you ask me for a home run, I'm able to deliver." So what happens in the first inning? Bases loaded. You guessed it. Bob Aspromonte, grand slam. I mean, this kid is just the ultimate good luck charm here. And They remained friends for a very long time. In fact, it's interesting, the tables were turned about 10 years later after Aspromonte was retired. He suffered an accident with an exploding car battery, and he got blinded in one eye by the battery acid. So Aspromonte needed the same surgery that Billy Bradley had gotten, and the two were able to keep in touch. And, you know, Bradley was able to provide some, you know, faith for Aspromonte that he was going to pull through. And while Aspromonte, by all accounts, didn't get complete 100% vision back in his eye, it was his right eye, he was still able to restore enough of it to where he could live a normal life. So it's amazing that, you know, first of all, Billy Bradley survives the lightning strike. Second, he's able to get his vision restored. And third, on three separate occasions, Bob Aspromonte, career 60 home runs, in a career that spanned 13 years and 1,324 games, he was able to come through on three separate occasions. And then when Aspromonte got injured with the exploding car battery, he was able to get in touch with Bradley, and they were able to walk each other through the situation here. So it's just an amazing story. And I remember when I pulled this card, I was like, wait a minute, was this the same guy? Because Bob Aspromonte had a brother, Ken Aspromonte, who also had a pretty decent career playing mostly for Cleveland. He would manage Cleveland in the early 70s, Ken Aspromonte. But it was indeed Bob Aspromonte who was the focal point of this amazing story with this youngster, Billy Bradley. And the story got turned into a movie called Blind Faith. It was a made-for-TV movie. And I believe that's where the story that I eventually saw in Reader's Digest came from, was this TV movie. But Bob Aspromonte, just an amazing set of circumstances in 1962 and 1963 in particular. All right, let's bring it back to the main story here. Aspromonte continues to be a standout player. I wouldn't call him a star player, but a standout player and a very consistent player for the Colt 45s, later the Astros, hitting in the upper 200s, you know, 260 to 280 range. Did have 12 home runs in 1964, but after that, you know, kind of got back down to earth, you know, single-digit home run production year after year. Now, he would leave Houston after the 1968 season, was traded to the Atlanta Braves for Marty Martinez, and he would spend a couple of seasons in Atlanta, although not at full-time status, 82 games in 1969, 62 games in 1970. Of course, he's in his early 30s, so his production is trickling down just a little bit. And he ends up going to the New York Mets, the Braves acquiring Ron Herbel for Bob Aspromonte. And of course, the Mets, even with David Wright, you know, they thought they nailed down the third base position. Of course, Wright's had numerous back injuries over the last few years. The Mets have never really been able to nail down a full-time, you know, long-term third baseman, and Bob Aspromonte was one of many who played the hot corner, but he did finish up his final season in New York with 104 games, .225 batting average, and yes, he even had five home runs in the rather spacious Shea Stadium. So Aspromonte, I told you how afterwards he suffered the eye injury with the exploding car battery. But then he was able to, once he recovered from that, became a businessman, moved back to the Houston area, ran a beer distributor for the Coors Company, and also ran a few Burger King franchises with his brother Ken. So the Aspromonte family continued to be productive in the Houston area. This was back in the early 80s. He was doing rather well with beer distribution and the Burger King franchises. And from an article that I read, I was able to unearth this from Inc. Magazine. That's INC, like Incorporated Magazine, from 1981. He ran his businesses much like a manager would run the dugout. And, you know, he would not be afraid to get down and dirty in the trenches with his workers to help make the team win. So it sounds like he was a pretty cool boss to work with. So Bob Aspromonte, a very average ball player in so many aspects. You know, you look at the stats and, you know, he had, like I said, a serviceable career, 13 seasons, over 1,000 games, career batting average of .252, pretty decent fielder. Like I said, consistent for many, many years. But, you know, a guy that doesn't stand out with the exception of that blind faith story that I told you about with young Billy Bradley. And again, all thoughts on Bob Aspromonte are very, very positive. He is still alive and well. In fact, just yesterday, celebrated his 79th birthday. So happy birthday, Bob Aspromonte, a guy who, like I said, in the grand scheme of baseball history, doesn't stand out. But if you are somehow related to Billy Bradley, or if you're old enough to remember the early days of the Houston Colt 45s and Astros, certainly Bob Aspromonte was one of those guys that stood out, not necessarily because of any flash and dash and wow, but he was a pretty consistent player and somebody that you could count on game in and game out. Now, if there's any kind of consistency with the Topps product in 1970, it is that it is extremely not that imaginative. As I mentioned earlier in the podcast, I think Topps went through a real creative drought from 1966 through 1970. Now, thankfully, that would be completely changed over the next few years, including the rather striking 1971 set, which we'll talk about next week. But you would see some pretty creative attempts of baseball cards in the 70s. Some turned out real good, some not so much. But you can't say they're not creative. I'm looking at you, 1972. But the 1970 set was the final thud in this creative drought. And even though, as I've mentioned, you know, the 68 set I've always liked, even though a lot of collectors don't, the burlap sack set, they're not crazy about that. And even though there are some good but not great things about 66, 67, and 69, the 70 top set has a lot left to be desired. And let's first look at the design of the set. Now, it's got this gray border. I won't call it silver, but it's kind of this light gray border around it. Not all that different from what you would see in the 1992 Leaf set, 1991 as well. And, you know, 1990 had a lot of silver to it, but there was a little more flash to the 1990 Leaf set. But, you know, if you listen to the podcast of those early 90s Leaf sets, I've always liked the silver border that they had. And I've always liked the gray border that Topps had here in 1970. But that's probably the only positive thing when it comes to the front of the card. Once you get around the border, you know, you've got a lot of space that's left to the photograph here, but the pictures are not very high quality. And then the rest of the design is just kind of pieced together. The team name of the player is in the upper right-hand corner. In this case, it's rather hard to read. It's red letters for Braves against a dark background, so it doesn't really stand out. And then at the bottom, on the bottom of the frame, the silver border, you have the player's name kind of written in this cheap Sharpie marker, and then the position that he played in the lower right-hand corner. And that was pretty much it. There is not a whole lot of design wow to it. That is kind of representative of the times after the wild and woolly 1960s. If you look at the historical timeline, once you got through 1969 and Man Walking on the Moon and Woodstock and all that, there was a big cultural thud in 1970, especially in America. Now, that's not to say there weren't things happening. You know, you've had, Nixon's bombing Cambodia. You've got, unrest at a lot of colleges. You've got the Kent State shootings. So certainly a lot of unhappiness. But when you think of the 60s as the flower child, the summer of love, the hippie, all the colors and the fun things, you know, there is definitely a turning of the page when you get to 1970. So in some aspects, it is somewhat reflective of the times, but that doesn't mean it's good. It's really boring. And a lot of collectors think the same. So the 1970 set, especially the front of the card, falls into the you love it or you don't. Now, one thing that redeems the set, if you flip the card over, the backs of the cards, much like the backs of the 69 Topps cards redeem that set, in my opinion, same thing happens with 1970. With the white cardstock, and this would be the last time that Topps would use the white cardstock for any of their cards right up until 1992, It really stands out, the stats that they have there, and it's because of the color combination. Now, not going with that bubblegum pink and black that really stood out, this stands out because it really contrasts. You've got the full white background, but also a dark blue, kind of a navy blue, and a gold mix of colors here. So it really does stand out. It looks really sharp, rather businesslike, which, you know, kind of does tie into the front of the card here. So if you look at the back of this card, you've got the full name here, Robert Thomas Aspermonte. You've got the background information. You've got the card number in the upper left-hand corner. If space permitted, a little trivial fact, and they do wedge one in here, holds nationally marks .974 percentage at third base, 1964, and only 11 errors. So fielding-wise, although 974 is not exactly a great fielding percentage, fielding-wise, they're trying to tip their cap here and say Aspermonte is a good guy out in the field. And with the full major minor league record here, pretty much takes up a lot of the space, since Aspermonte's time did go back a full 13 years from the last reported stats for this card. So even though the 1970 Topps design is not a winner in my mind, the back of the card does redeem the whole card just a little bit. But again, overall, this is not a great card. It is not very popular. This is a set that a lot of collectors have kind of moved on. And again, looking in the context, because Topps would certainly pick up its game in 1971, 1970 left a lot to be desired. It also left a lot of cards, 720 card set. That was the biggest set to date for Topps. And some interesting notes here. The big rookie card, Thurman Munson, would certainly be a standout. Also, Bill Buckner is a notable first-year card from this set. But certainly the Munson card is the one that carries it. Also, Nolan Ryan, his third-year card here. He had a lot of young stars, you know, the Steve Carltons and Tom Seavers, Nolan Ryan, as I mentioned. Pete Rose would be one. You had a lot of stars from the mid-60s who were featured in some of their early career cards here, so that kind of helps it out too. Also, this is the first top set since 1951 to not feature a Mickey Mantle card, as he did retire prior to the 1969 season. And also an interesting quirk about the 1970 set is that you will not see any Milwaukee Brewers cards. Now, of course, the history of the Seattle Pilots is the Pilots' move from Seattle to Milwaukee was not approved of until literally days before the 1970 season. In fact, as far as the Pilots knew, when they were in spring training in Arizona that March, they were going to be back in Seattle, even though there were all sorts of rumors that they might relocate. But the approval to sell the team to Bud Selig happened, I want to say, like April 2nd or March 30th. But it was literally days before the season started. So you don't see any Milwaukee Brewers cards here. But what's really perplexing to me, and I haven't been able to find a reasonable answer to this, even though the sale was approved right before the start of the season, Topps was still making sets in several series, and a 720 card set that would be broken up over seven series, I believe. So for some reason, Topps did not decide to change all the Pilots cards to Brewers cards in, say, series two or three or any of the later series. So for whatever reason, they just stuck with the Pilots template and pushed it out there. So it is a chance, whereas the 1969 set, you weren't able to see all of the Pilots players wearing the Pilots gear, especially the earlier series, because they had yet to play a game or yet to play a spring training game to where you could get pictures of them in their uniforms. The best way to collect a full 1969 Seattle Pilots set of baseball cards is to collect the 1970 top set of Seattle Pilots players. Even though the team was in Milwaukee, you have no Milwaukee cards. It is all Pilots players. And there is a very unique card that is in there Topps did not do the team cards in 1969 for obvious reasons, because they had four new teams and they really couldn't assemble that. So they got back to it in 1970. Well, there is a Seattle Pilots team card in 1970 featuring the Pilots in the infield and behind them the crumbling architecture of six Seattle stadiums. So that's a kind of a neat throwback there. And just an interesting thing from 1970. If you wanted Milwaukee Brewers cards, you had to wait until the 1971 set. So as for 1970, while there's some interesting quirks and a heavyweight rookie card in Thurman Munson, other than that, it's just one of those sets that you can take or leave. Now, if you're interested in collecting a handful of 1970 Topps sets just to fill out, or 70 Topps cards, excuse me, just to fill out your vintage collection, this is a good set to do so, again, because the 1970 set was 720 cards, so it's pretty massive. There's plenty of options of cards that are out there. And also because it is not a very popular set, the prices are kind of low on it. And one thing that really hampered the 1970 set, for whatever reason, cards were constantly cut off center. In fact, if you look at the Aspromonte card, it's a good example. It's pretty much 90-10 with it leaning to the left. And you can see that on the back of the card as well. Also, what would prove to be problematic, that silver border, it did show wear and tear a little too easily. Not as bad as the 67 Topps cards because of the olive green backs. In fact, this is where the back of the card redeems the front of the card. It doesn't show the wear and tear too much, but you can easily get some nicks and scratches and little rubbed off areas from wear and tear. It shows a lot. But if you don't care much about the condition of cards, this is something that actually benefits you in the sense that you can get a set or a handful of cards. I shouldn't say a set, but you can get a lot of probably, I don't know, you could probably get 50 cards for maybe a quarter a piece. So what's that break down to? I was promised there would be no math. It comes down to, you know, roughly $12.5, $13 for 50 cards. That's a pretty reasonable number, depending on the player. Obviously, if they're all common cards, you could probably get them for as low as 10 if you're looking for a block of 50. But if you have some star cards in there, you can still get them at a pretty decent value because the 70 set is kind of put on the back burner. Now, that is not the case for 1971. As we will look back at one of the most popular sets in Topps history. Yes, it's right up there. I've always said that if I've had to pick the top three, you know, I'll put 65 Topps in there, I'll put 87 Topps in there. And typically, what makes the top three, in my opinion, 1971. It was artistic. It was a thing of beauty. It was a change from the norm. Topps kind of turning back the clock on a few elements of that set, but also starting to experiment a little bit, especially in the name of action shots. You would see your first action shot photographs in the 1971 set. Now, that would lead to some hilarious action shots in later sets, but 1971 really breaking the mold on a lot of fronts for Topps, and it would kind of reinvigorate the brand. As I mentioned, you know, this is a five-year creative lull in the late 60s, ending in 1970. You could say that the creative juices really got going for Topps for the next 5 to 6 years with the 71 Topps set. So we will discuss that next Tuesday. Also, be on the lookout for the Flashback Friday edition. We'll remind you throughout the weekend to check that out. Also, we will have the 77 Topps pack break for you soon. We will also put up for auction the 84 Topps rack pack with the Tony Gwynn card showing. And you can capture all of this excitement via our Twitter feed at Waxing Gumstains. And you can listen to our shows at any time via Audio Boom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and TuneIn. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.